These are the stories that you need to know about today. U.S. officials arrive at the Kremlin. They stay past midnight. Is a peace deal at hand? And what does this say about U.S. and Russia relations? Boy, here's a sign of the times. Stocks from European companies that make weapons are plunging. And Witkoff has canceled his meeting with Zelensky. He's going home. What does that tell you? Also, President Putin apparently fed up with Europe's constant insults and threats. He fires back. We don't want war with Europe, he says, but if they want war, bring it on. This is the Sanchez Effect. Let's do this. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. Past midnight. That's how long they talked last night in the Kremlin. America and Russia are working it out without Europe, without Ukraine, both of which appear to be collapsing, crumbling under the weight of fraud and corruption investigations. In fact, we learned earlier today that Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner decided they're not even going to go talk to them. They skip Europe and they skip Zelensky. They canceled their expected meeting with him. As for the meeting with Mr. Putin, it was as generally positive as expected. The tip-off for that was this video of the U.S. team. There's Witkoff and Jared Kushner amicably strolling through Moscow, asked whether peace is closer or further away following the talks. Russia's spokesperson says definitely not further. But they're still figuring out? Well, they're still trying to nail down where the territorial lines are going to be drawn and how exactly U.S.-Russia relations will move forward.
The conversation was very substantial and constructive. Naturally, we discussed the contents of the documents we had previously received with our American colleagues. We didn't discuss the specific wording of these American documents. We discussed the essence of what was included in them, and we could agree on some of the points, and the president confirmed this to his interlocutors. We also criticized some of them, and the president didn't hide our critical and even negative attitude toward a number of proposals. But the main thing is that we had a very substantial discussion. I emphasize once again that the parties declared their readiness to continue working together to achieve a long-term peace settlement in Ukraine.
But the real headlines were made prior to the meeting, when President Putin took questions from reporters. This surprised a lot of people. Feeling like European elites have for too long lied about him, insulted Russia, threatened Russia with war, President Putin seemed to suddenly just fire back at the Europeans after he was asked a question about Europe's criticisms.
У них нет мирной повестки.
They have no peace agenda. They are warmongers, even when they allegedly tried to introduce some amendments to President Trump's proposal. All these changes have only one goal in mind. They are aimed at blocking and putting on hold this peace process. They are trying to make demands that are unacceptable for Russia, and they understand this. And then later, they will try to accuse Russia of stopping the peace process. This is their objective. I've said this 100 times. We have no plans to fight against Europe. But if Europe wants to fight, and if they start this fight, then we are ready.
There it is. He seems to be saying, look, we don't want war, and we don't certainly want to start a war, but if they do, bring it on. And then he doubled down. You know how he doubled down? He reminded reporters that the meticulous way in which the Russian army has waged this war in Ukraine, that's not how Russia would wage war against Europe, he says.
If Europe suddenly starts a war with us, this is not Ukraine. We operate there in a surgical manner, very carefully. You understand, right? This is not a war in the direct modern sense of the word. If Europe suddenly wants to start its own war and does so, a situation could quickly arise where we will have no one to negotiate with.
Now, as peace negotiations go, time is most definitely on Russia's side. Its army is decimating the opposition right now. Ukraine's military, according to reports from the front, they're out of supplies, they're out of escape routes, and they're out of will. Meanwhile, Russia's army is steamrolling ahead while using leaflets now to try and get the AFU to surrender. Look at these maps, right? Here's a big, nice, long map I put together for you to focus on three cities. First, Guyapole. There, Russia's defense ministry, we've learned, has just announced that what is left of it, Ukrainian troops, they're now being driven out. Of course, that is in the region of Zaporizhzhia, all the way at the bottom there. See that? Now, let's head north to Pokrovsk. There, defense officials say that the situation is well in hand, confirming the city has been taken, something we kind of already knew. Now we go further north still, where defense officials also confirm that they have captured and fully control Volchansk. That's in the Kharkov region. Just to show you how large this area is that we're talking about, all the way from Volchansk to Guyapole, it's equal to the distance of Virginia to New York. It's a lot of land. So what's happening on the ground? Well, it's telling. Out of manpower and out of drones, what is left for the AFU in places like Pokrovsk is being mopped up. That's what they're calling it, a mop-up operation. You want to see it? There's tons of examples that you can see of this, by the way, if you go to YouTube. But I found one in particular that I found, well, it's very illustrative and it's very striking. Let's go to the video, Gene. Watch. In this video, Russians spot a lonely drone above them. Do they shoot it down? No. Instead, they watch it and they follow it. And they watch a drone return to an occupied house from where it was dispatched. There it is. Ukrainian fighters are there. Those fighters don't know that they're being watched. The Russians then take out this thing here. It's a specialized drone, attach a missile to it. They fly it right into the house. Watch, literally right through the front door, and they eliminate the drone, its operators, and many other AFU forces that were in the occupied building. Boom! Scenes like these are bad news for the Ukrainian military, but it's even worse news for Europeans. It signals the end is probably near. In fact, even the talk of Trump's peace plan, you know what it's done, right? And that it's in the works? It sent European stocks tumbling down. The European stocks of weapons makers in particular. Look at this graph we put together of what happened when Trump first introduced his plan. Here you can see the fear of peace negotiations sent the shares of Europe's major manufacturers of weapons and war equipment spiraling down. Look at the line for Rheinmetall. That's Germany's largest arms maker. It fell 5%. Now look at the British company, BAE. It fell approximately 3.5%. Sweden's Saab went down nearly 6%. Italy's Leonardo went down 2% on this chart. You know, think about this as you watch this. You can only imagine, right? You can only imagine what's happening. Somebody in the C-suites or stockholders pick up the phone and they reach out to political elites, right? You know, and somebody like Frederick Merz or the EU's Ursula von der Leyen or France's Emmanuel Macron. Hey, what are you guys doing over there? We're losing money. You can't let this war come to an end. This war has to continue. I could see them saying. And then mysteriously, we see something like this.
We will continue to help Ukraine, ladies and gentlemen, even against the resistance of the political left and the Russia-friendly right here in this house. We will continue this support. The funds of diplomacy are exhausted.
Yeah, that's been the pattern all throughout. No matter the corruption, no matter the facts on the ground, no matter the success of the peace talks, Merz and others like him, who are, according to their own approval polls, disliked by their own citizens, they just continue to say no and no and no to peace and make it clear that this war must continue. But Europe is fracturing. Yep, countries like Belgium, Hungary, Slovakia, and others are saying, we're out. We don't want anything to do this anymore. No more money for Ukraine. And overnight, scandal gripped the EU with this headline. See that? The EU's former top diplomat has been arrested for fraud. Federica Mogherini is one of three people picked up in what is a sprawling fraud investigation. Police even raided the EU's diplomatic services, leaving many wondering how far into the EU this probe might reach. The bust will likely put a damper on the EU's latest scheme, a plan to steal Russia's frozen assets and hand them over to Ukraine. I know, it seems crazy. If you're a bank, you can't just take some depositor's money and give it to somebody else. But here's Merce bragging about it.
You say this cannot be done above the heads of the Europeans without agreement of the Europeans. But what leverage does Europe actually have?
Well, there are so many elements in this plan which require the agreement of the European side. And I give you an example. The Russian assets, which are based in Brussels, cannot be paid out to the Americans. That is unthinkable. So if this plan comes into reality, the support of the Europeans is definitely needed. And that's the reason why we are on the table.
It cannot be paid out to the Americans, but it can be paid out to the Ukrainians. What the hell is he talking about? Did you hear what he just said? So desperate is he to continue this war, he's willing to risk the credibility of Europe's banking system. Who in their right mind would ever put money into a bank or a banking system or a financial center with a record of taking that money and giving it away to others for political reasons? That's called weaponizing a deposit. That's not a good move. Even Europeans themselves are telling them, no, we're opposed to this. Don't do this. That would be stupid for the future. Look what happened to the dollar since it was weaponized. Just in the last 3 years, the U.S. dollar has lost 50%, half of its value compared to gold. This is what many, even inside Germany, are telling Merz as he tries to push through another $11.5 billion for Ukraine. Here's the AfD's Alice Weidel speaking at the Bundestag.
Your budget is not constitutional. Instead of cutting unnecessary expenditures as promised and consolidating the budget, you're throwing money away in handfuls out the window. $11.5 billion for Ukraine without knowing whether the money will end up once again in the corrupt hands of war profiteers. Thank God through Donald Trump we have a real chance for peace, to which you have not contributed any part. You have contributed quite the opposite. Quite the opposite.
And I should also tell you, that's obviously pushback in America, right? You've seen it. Citizens, people I know, people I talk to on the phone, are saying that they're tired of paying for needless wars with their tax money, as expressed as well now by some guy in Congress. I've never heard of him, but he's quite eloquent. Here's Representative Pat Harrigan.
The corruption inside Ukraine is no longer a rumor. More than $360 billion has flowed into the country since 2022. And now Zelensky's inner circle is being tied to a theft operation so large it's hard to comprehend. A chief of staff doesn't siphon off $100 million on his own. And no credible observer can possibly think the president was unaware. This is what happens when a world funds a war on emotion instead of intellect. There was never a plan to win. And there has never been accountability. As someone who has lived the consequences of bad strategy, I take our national security seriously. Americans deserve leadership that protects their families, not politicians who treat foreign aid like a blank check to feed a meat grinder.
A blank check to feed a meat grinder. Also jumping on the anti-Ukraine bandwagon, although not calling him out by name, is Turkey's Recep Erdogan. Unable to compete with the Russian army on the front, right? Ukraine lately has chosen to instead lob missiles into the Black Sea. They're attacking commercial tankers there in the Black Sea. So far, they've hit three ships, and the latest one was off the coast of Turkey, which is why this guy is saying this now.
The war between Russia and Ukraine appears to have reached a point where it clearly threatens navigational safety in the Black Sea. The targeting of merchant ships in our exclusive economic zone on Friday signals a war in escalation. We cannot condone these attacks, which threaten navigational safety, life, and the environment, especially in our own exclusive waters. We're issuing the necessary warnings to all parties.
It's fascinating to think of what they're doing. It doesn't look like they have the wherewithal to compete with the Russian military, you know, at least in the theater, right? In the military theater, in the on the front lines. So instead, they're just taking missiles and lobbing them into the Black Sea and hitting tankers. Now, that's a problem. President Putin, by the way, was asked about that yesterday, and here's how he commented.
Attacks on tankers in neutral territory, or even within the special economic zone of other states, are piracy. What the Ukrainian armed forces are doing now is simply that. What kind of retaliatory measures can there be? First, we can expand the range of our strikes against port facilities and ships entering the Ukrainian ports. If this continues, we will consider the possibility of retaliatory measures against the vessels of those ships that help Ukraine carry out these piracy operations. The most radical way is to cut off Ukraine from the sea. I hope that the Ukrainian military leadership, the political leadership, as well as those who stand behind them, will consider whether it is worth continuing this practice.
Now I want to bring somebody in who knows a lot about war, both from the inside and out. He's a U.S. Marine who served in Iraq. Matthew Cole also worked for the State Department, where he was assigned, in fact, to his post in Afghanistan. Matthew, nice to meet you. It's a pleasure to have you here with us. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me join you, Rick.
Hey, I'm just wondering about your own service because, you know, that's still a there's still a bruise there for most of us as Americans when we think of both Iraq and Afghanistan. I rather than jump to Ukraine, I'd almost love to hear your thoughts because you were there, man. You saw it, you experienced it, you felt it. I have said on the air many times, Iraq in particular was just a big lie. Do you get mad for me saying that? Because you were there and you served.
No, Rick. I'm very appreciative of you saying that. I'm grateful that you have the one, you understand what the war really was, one great big lie, but you also have the convictions and the courage and the honesty to say so. Many people on air still all these years later, when 75% of Americans feel that way, they're still afraid to speak out against it. And that's because of the conditioning, the inculcation, the brainwashing, for lack of a better term, that exists in the United States from the war state, you know, from all aspects of our culture and society. The ritual obligation of Americans to thank veterans for their service. Yeah. And that, of course, then transforms into essentially a subjugation or an oppression or an ability of the ruling class, the establishment, you know, the powers to be, however you want to describe them, as being able to suffocate any dissent. And that dissent includes honest conversation, just like you had, just like your opening monologue here was very honest, very candid, very clear, in a way that outside of folks like yourself and, you know, others in independent alternative media spaces, you do not hear. Your recitation of what occurred yesterday, if I go and I look at Reuters, if I look at Axios, if I look at the New York Times today, that is almost an entirely different analysis of the conversations yesterday between the Americans and the Russians that you're going to read in the American press. The first report I saw yesterday that came after Steve Witkoff had left Moscow just clearly stated from Reuters that nothing occurred. They met for 5 hours and nothing occurred. And then today when I woke up, I see reports, you know, from Reuters and Axios where they walk that back a bit, but it's still so laden. It's still so the dictates of having to frame this as being unwise, as being crooked, as the negotiations themselves being the corruptions, the negotiations themselves being the lies, or the efforts to engender peace being the obscenity as opposed to the war itself.
Yeah.
And I do want to relate one story that I thought of while you were speaking, particularly about the weapons companies. Mm-hmm. And so after I resigned in protest from the Afghan war, I got set up in a think tank in Washington, D.C. And at the end of 2011, beginning of 2012, I accidentally, inadvertently, they invited me, they, the special representative for Afghan-Pakistan affairs, the senior most person in the U.S. government for the Afghan war, reporting directly to President Obama. I got invited to a meeting he was having, and there were about 20 people in that meeting. And again, it was inadvertent. I should not have been there. I don't know why they put me on the list. There were probably four or five other men and women from think tanks. The other 15 or so people in that meeting were lobbyists. They were from weapons companies. They were from development companies. They were from the companies like Booz Allen Hamilton that service the Central Intelligence Agency.
Wow.
And the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, if people remember, at that point in 2011, 2012, President Obama was trying to honor his commitment to draw down from Afghanistan. And the pushback from Washington, D.C. was enormous because we were spending $120 billion a year on the war. We were spending $300 million a day on that war. So a lot of people's fortunes were in jeopardy here if this war came to an end. And essentially, the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, who came out of the national security establishment, who was a true believer in American empire, right? A true believer in the purposes of wars like Afghanistan. His message to these assembled representatives of the weapons company, the development industry, there were bank representatives were there, you know, et cetera, was let your people know we're not leaving, that we are staying. And what he meant by that was you got to get your lobbyists into Congress and make sure they are not backing this retreat, this withdrawal, this you know, aspect of this policy of us leaving Afghanistan. You know, and I saw that right there occur, where the head of the Afghan war for the U.S. government was telling the representatives of the weapons industries, you need to go to Congress and you need to make sure that this war doesn't end.
What the hell are they even doing in that meeting?
I still have the agenda from that buried away in one of my spaces here in a desk someplace. You know, if I know, I would have pulled it out and had it ready for us. You know, I'll send you a copy afterwards, you know. But, you know, who was at this thing, why they were there. Exactly. This is the type of thing
they don't belong there.
I think
that's a military. It's a meeting between military people and some civilians who are planning a war. What the hell is Raytheon doing there? What the hell is Dynamic doing there? What the hell is Pratt & Whitney doing there?
I'm not saying those guys.
I'm just making up those names, but I mean.
Well, no, they were there. It was. It was like Boeing. It was like Lockheed. You know, like it was. That's who I'm talking about.
Yeah.
You know, the other think tank people there were, of course, besides myself, again, not. I wasn't supposed to be there because when I went up and spoke to the special representative for Afghanistan, Pakistan later, and I introduced myself, he said, yeah, I know who you are. And he kind of turned away and walked away, you know, because I was saying, you know, we got to get out of this war.
Good
you know, our Marines and soldiers are dying from vain over there. We're killing innocent Afghans for the sake of a corrupt drug lord and warlord government that we put in place, you know. And but I think the way most people look at it is a little bit upside down. They had every right to be there. These weapons companies, these banks, the fossil fuel companies, the think tanks funded by all them, because these wars are for them.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
They are the constituents for which these wars are waged. Yeah. So the idea that they shouldn't be there. Yes, of course.
They have no friggin' business. As an American citizen, right. I'm telling you, I elect people to make decisions for me and for my wife and for my children and for my grandchildren. And I respect the people who serve my country and expect them to make decisions based on what's good for my wife and my children and my grandchildren.
Right,
what the
right,
hell does some corporation have to do? I didn't elect that corporate. I don't want them in that meeting. I think it's insulting that you have just told me that you were in a meeting where they were invited.
The reality is we have a system of legalized bribery in this country as our government, right? That's how our political process works. And so the spoils of that are that these men and women who represent these various industries, they essentially control their sectors, their fields, what their industries, right? I mean, so that's the way it's viewed. That's the way it's understood. And for those who are true believers in the American empire, like the special representative for Afghan Pakistan, he wasn't someone who was interested in profit seeking. He wasn't interested in bettering the financials of the military industrial complex. He really does believe in the American empire. And so this is where you intersect. And this is where you see how people like him who are trying to pursue these, you know, agendas, the wars overseas, the occupations, ensuring American supremacy or hegemony is not disturbed. They see these weapons companies, the banks, the fossil fuel companies as having the resources needed to get what they want.
That's sick.
So at a time when the Afghan war is incredibly unpopular, when it's clear that we're losing, that this is an unwinnable war, when the president himself wants to get out of the war, those who are like the special representative, who believe in America's in ensuring America's dominance around the world, that means having wars like Afghanistan, well, then you have to enlist the aid of these weapons companies because they're the ones who have more lobbyists on Capitol Hill than there are members of Congress. That's an actual fact. There are more weapons industry lobbyists than there are members of Congress.
You just reminded me of something. I played a tape here. I don't know. Maybe Boris, my producer, will remind me. I think it was 3 weeks ago or 3.5 weeks ago. We got this video in of Zelensky going to the United States, bypassing Congress, bypassing the president, and going directly to a meeting with the people that you just named. The CEOs of all these big corporations, essentially doing a deal with them for weapons that, you know, that he wanted to get over there. Again, I asked the same thing. What in the friggin' hell do these guys have to do with setting policy for my country and for the citizens of the United States of America? This is so out of hand, it's ridiculous.
And I think what those the message that Zelensky and others representing the Ukrainian government would say to those CEOs of Lockheed, Raytheon, General Dynamics, et cetera, as well as to the CEOs of institutions like BlackRock and State Street and Goldman Sachs, is that if you want your money, you better keep this war going. So when Zelensky goes and meets with these representatives from the weapons industries, these are men and women who have backlogs or back orders of tens of billions of dollars for these wars, or in particular for the Ukraine war. There's a backlog or back order of American weaponry for this war, not just going to Ukraine, but going to the Europeans as well, totaling $40, $50 billion. So if Raytheon, if Northrop Grumman, if General Dynamics, if Lockheed, if they want that $40 or $50 billion or whatever the back order comes to, they better keep this war going. And so that means after they meet with Zelensky and he says this to them, they turn around and they call Senator Schumer, they call Senator McConnell, they still call them Senator Graham, and they say, you got to keep this war going because of blah, 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 blah. And then, of course, you also have the imperialists, you have the neoconservatives, you have the liberal interventionists, you have the American foreign policy establishment, again, who believe in the empire, as well saying to Senator Schumer, to Senator McConnell, to Senator Graham, this is the right thing. Otherwise, and they list all the boogeymen, or America's credibility is at stake.
Of course,
the same things we've seen before, right?
Yeah, they're coming to get us in the night. The boogeyman is scary. And these are probably the people who forced Boris Johnson a couple of years ago to basically come to Kiev and tell the Mr. Zelensky at the time, whatever you do, do not sign a peace deal. This war has to continue. It could have been over right there. The Russians were ready to sign the paper, and essentially they would have gotten nothing compared to what they have now and will get in the next couple of months. They could have ended the war right there.
It in their fever, in their mania, whether it's Boris Johnson, whether it's Secretary Lloyd Austin, or on the American side, Tony Blinken, Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton, these are people who represent, again, the American empire. And the idea of the American empire ever shrinking is something that they can't ever accept, let alone the idea of passing up an opportunity to expand the empire. These are all men and women who are adherents, they're acolytes of Henry Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski. They really do believe that the world is a chessboard, right? And so, you have both the profit-seeking aspects of this, where the Ukraine war is a good idea for the Americans because we're going to kick the Russians out of Western Europe. You know, Rick, in my understanding of where does this, what's the genesis of this? Certainly we can go back to George W. Bush's administration, but I look back to Barack Obama's administration, and you look and you say, what happened in, you know, after 2012? Because if we all remember, Barack Obama mocks Mitt Romney in the debates in 2012 for saying that Russia is America's prime adversary, one of its prime adversaries. Mm-hmm. And Barack Obama mocks him and says that Romney doesn't know what he's talking about. But then within a year, American policy has become so hostile to the Russians. So what changed, Rick? Well, what changed was fracking. What changed was the fact that now all of a sudden Americans were getting a ton of oil and natural gas out of the ground that just years before they felt was impossible to ever get. We felt would be stranded.
And they want to sell it to the Germans.
So now what do you have? Now you have the American energy companies expanding their LNG export terminals. You look at the timing between the $10 billion or however large the expansion was of the LNG terminal, export terminal at Cove Point, coinciding with exactly the same time that American policy becomes very adversarial to Russia. And so the idea that if we can get Russia out of Western and Central Europe, and now, of course, you see the pushing of the Americans to get their liquid natural gas into Ukraine, that the rebuilding of Ukraine will be done via American liquid natural gas. You know, so when you look at this war in Ukraine and you can say there have been no victors, that's true to an extent, as all wars are in many ways. But then you also have to come back to what you were getting at in your monologue and what you talked when you just were speaking so well of Iraq and Afghanistan, is that no, there have been some victors. And so you look at this war with Ukraine and Russia and you say, well, certainly the American and the Qatari natural gas companies, they have benefited tremendously. You know, in the United States, because of this war, becomes the largest exporter of liquid natural gas in the world, right? I mean, so there are plenty of companies that have benefited from. So you have this, again, this confluence, this dovetailing of these two interests, whether it's the imperial, neoconservative, liberal interventionists, we got to maintain American hegemony mindset, or it's just, hey, this is good for our bank account.
Yeah, but if you go by your argument, essentially they're doing something for the sake of, you know, the mighty dollar, as we would say, at the expense of the lives of, you know, who knows, countless, maybe a million Ukrainians. Do they not care?
Right, that's yeah.
They're ruining the country. No, They've destroyed the country.
No, they don't care. They don't care. But I think that's the reality of governments around the world and throughout history, that you've had this type of callousness, this willingness to see other people suffer so that you can gain. I mean, there have been plenty of studies that show that sociopaths and psychopaths dominate the top levels of our government and corporations. So their willingness to utilize another country to bleed Ukraine for their own interests, again, whether it's their financial or it's their philosophical interests, they see it as useful. And they brag about it.
You know what's fascinating, too? When was the last time we won a war? Can you name one? What? Maybe the one
The last time the United States won a war on its own?
Yeah, just one. We could walk away saying, yay, we won.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to go back more than 120 years to the Spanish-American War. I mean, certainly the United States contributed and took part and was a major player in the First and Second World Wars,
doubt. And we deserve credit for that.
But in the sense of when did we win a war on our own where we had clearly established a dominance, where our goals were met,
exactly,
where we didn't have follow-on blowback or consequences? People will make the argument, well, the first Iraq war, the Persian Gulf War of 1990-1991.
Not if you had to fight it again in two years.
I, you know, myself and my friends were in the Iraq War, the second Iraq War, because of the first Iraq War. Right. The same thing, too. World War II, it's World War II. It was the consequence of World War I. There was no victory from World War I. It gave us World War II.
But the point I'm making, Matt, is that I think these people that you are so well introducing us to, they don't care if the war is won or lost. They get guys, citizens like us, rah, rah, we got to go get Iraq because they're about to blow up the world and they got WMDs, et cetera. And I, as an American, going, okay, let's do it. You know, I was a sucker, right? But then I realized they're telling me that, but that's bullcrap. They don't need or want to win the war. They just want to have a war. The war is there for the sake of the war. The war is a racket in and of itself. It's not to be won. It's just to be fought to make money. Am I wrong? What am I missing?
No, that's exactly what Major General Smedley Butler, the most decorated Marine Corps, the most decorated Marine in Marine Corps history, said. I'm trying to find a quote that I had handy.
Yeah, he said, war's a racket. Yeah.
He said, war's a racket. He said, actually, I'll quote it, Rick, for you. War's a racket. It always has been. It is possibly the oldest, easily the most profitable, surely the most vicious. It is the only one international in scope. It is the only one in which the profits are reckoned in dollars and the losses in lives.
Jeez.
And, you know, this is a man who fought around the world for the United States. He at one point, Smedley Butler says, you know, Al Capone is nothing compared to me. Butler called himself a gangster for capitalism. He said, Al Capone has nothing on me. He said, Al Capone operated in three districts. I operated on three continents, right?
Wow.
I mean, and this idea that you have the wars because this is the reality of empire, or this is the reality of the capitalist system. I mean, you see that in political theory explained from the left to the right. So you can go and look at what Vladimir Lenin said about this, or you can go on the right, you can go and look and see what Murray Rothbard said about this.
Yeah.
The idea that war is the health of the state. And certainly the idea, more specifically for American policy, really is enshrined following the end of the Cold War, when the United States has become the world's sole superpower. And so the George H.W. Bush administration essentially puts into reality a policy that the United States is the sole superpower. We are the hegemon. We have supremacy or primacy in this world. And it will be the duty of every successive administration to maintain that primacy. And any threat that comes up has to be destroyed. I mean, this was what George Kennan said to Harry Truman at the end of the Second World War. Kennan said, look, Mr. President, the United States has more than 55% of the world's wealth. We have less than 5% of the world's population, and it will be the obligation of every successful administration to maintain that imbalance. I mean, so there, you know, we can do a chicken and egg type conversation of which came first, the imperial ambitions of empire or just the plain old making a buck ambitions. But they're so intertwined, you know, in terms of, say, the United States empire, that we could spend days, you know, speculating, pulling it apart. But yeah, we'd have to understand this is where we're at.
You know, there's one thing that happened in the last few years that really makes me angry when I hear people say it. The war in Afghanistan, as you well know, you worked there. The war in Afghanistan lasted 20 years. And the only criticism of it by our media is the last week.
Right.
That's it.
Right.
The only thing they found wrong with 20 years of war, where we accomplished absolutely nothing and spent a trillion friggin' dollars, was they didn't like the way we exited. It's like, you can't make this stupidity up.
Right. The Afghan war, even though it was unwinnable, and every day the Afghan security forces over the last 5, 6, 7 years of the war were taking 60 casualties. The toll on the Afghan people is just, it hasn't been accurately reported. I'll cite you one person who's done a fantastic job of that. Azmat Khan, who's a journalist for the New York Times. She's at the Columbia University Journalism School now. But in 2021, following the fall of the Taliban, she visited southern Afghanistan, and she did surveys in Afghan villages in southern Afghanistan. And she found that that on the average, an Afghan family lost 5 people to American or British or Canadian or coalition airstrikes during the war. So in southern Afghanistan, that was the toll. Every family had lost 5 people, according to this research, to airstrikes during the war. I mean, so the toll of this was enormous. The fact that it was that scale and scope of war. Again, we were spending $300 million a day for 20 years, and it was just not even spoken about in the United States. You know, after we got out in 2021, people started doing research because they said, oh, yeah, it's right. We were fighting this war in Afghanistan. And what they found was that the major television networks in the United States, they were spending single-digit leaked in terms of minutes of coverage per year on the Afghan war.
I was one of them. I mean, one of the reasons CNN fired me was because I wanted to do more stories on this. I wanted to invite people like Larry Wilkerson on to explain to me why this is such a joke and what we were doing and why it was wrong. And, you know, I got so much pushback at the top at CNN that eventually they found a reason to get rid of me. But the real reason was I was asking a lot of questions about who was feeding money to Congress and why we were continuing this war that made no damn sense. So, yeah, I was allowed to do maybe one 30-second segment a day during the war in Afghanistan while we were covering it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's the joke, and it's a terrible joke, but the joke is that this reconstruction of Afghanistan, where the United States spent more than it spent on the Marshall Plan for Europe following World War II, that the reconstruction in Afghanistan was unsuccessful in Afghanistan. However, it was very successful in Northern Virginia and in Maryland. And if you look at this, if you know the area, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, Potomac.
The construction boom in the suburbs of Washington, D.C. over the last 20 years, fueled by the U.S. wars overseas, not just the Iraq and Afghan wars, but wars in Libya, in Somalia, Yemen, Syria, et cetera. You're talking an expenditure for the Pentagon from 2001 to 2021 of $16 trillion. Hmm. Half of that, actually more than half of that, about 53%, so more than $8 trillion went to the weapons companies. And that money then gets spread out, right? So you're talking, again, this $8 trillion over 20 years directly to the weapons companies, not even just the rest of the money that bleeds off from the government in other ways. That money then gets spread, of course, through the banks. That money gets spread, of course, through the construction companies.
But it doesn't go to the average American. But you know, Matt, it doesn't go to my dad, didn't go to my mom, doesn't go to my wife, doesn't go to, you know, people I know who I care about, who are my friends and my neighbors. The only thing they get to do is go to a football game and cheer when they see the soldiers come on in uniform, when they see that stupid plane fly overhead before every damn game, because nothing in America can be done without us having to applaud for the military. And you know what? I have all the respect in the world for the guys who wear the uniforms, but I have a feeling they're being used in our country. So these parasites that you just described, who attended that meeting that you described in Afghanistan, use the soldiers and use the emotions of the American people to make money off of them. That's my take.
Absolutely. I mean, Rick, if you go back and you look through American history, what's the wealthiest part of the United States? And of course, that changes over time. At times it's New York, at times it's Tulsa and Dallas because of the oil, it's Silicon Valley, of course. But then around 2004, 2005, you start to see that the wealthiest part of the United States is being reported as the Washington, D.C. suburbs. And that's the way it still remains.
Yeah.
That because of these war budgets, right? I mean, so the extraction, the exploitation, this is what empire does. It doesn't just extract or exploit or take or ruin overseas. It does it here. Give me an example. We'll shift focus and we'll bring it up to right now. The United States, according to people like Stephen Semler and Bill Hartung and the Cost of War Project at Brown University and the Quincy Institute, who've looked at this, the United States spent possibly up to $35 billion in defense of Israel in the last 2 years, whether it's direct assistance to Israel or our fighter jets shooting down Iranian drones over Jordan, things like that. $35 billion. That was essentially the same cost that we were talking about that shut the U.S. government down for 50 days. Wow. When you look at what was it going to cost per year to provide these subsidies for the Affordable Care Act, it was roughly $35 billion a year. So the opportunity costs here, and we could talk about all
schools,
the trade-offs.
Infrastructure,
when you have a $1 trillion military budget, that for which there is almost unanimous bipartisan support. And then you say, well, why don't we have better infrastructure? Why can't we have healthcare, universal education, you know, et cetera? The answer is always we can't afford it.
Yeah.
And you know, this cost, again, $16 trillion to the Pentagon over 20 years. What else could that have been utilized for?
Well, guess what? I am reporting right now from a country with all of its faults. And by the way, not just this country. I could be reporting from Ukraine right now. I could be reporting from Israel, right? Countries where that money is going to, who do have the things Americans don't have. There is universal health insurance here. There is in Israel. There is in Ukraine. There is maternity leave paid for women of up to 6 or 7 weeks in this country. There is not in the United States. There is a requirement by employers that they have to give a certain time off to all employees in this country and in Ukraine and in Iraq and in Israel, but not in our country, not in your and mine, your country and mine. That's a little unsettling, isn't it? I mean, it's crazy to think that, but you're right, man. That's what really makes me angry is we do give all this money to all of these countries and it's being pilfered by all of these people you describe to us, and yet the people of America aren't getting it. They're not benefiting from any of this stuff. So why the hell are we doing it? You know, we're down to, I'll give you the last 30 seconds because I'm being told we got to go to a break.
It goes back to this idea of a war being a racket and the idea to intertwine then with the notion that we have a system of legalized bribery here. This is what makes the American empire so especially dangerous. Because you have, again, this intersection of thought, belief, a religiosity, of American exceptionalism that intersects with vast, vast money-making. Yeah. And that's why you see this pushback that we first spoke about, this idea that how can Steve Witkoff go to Moscow after just meeting with the Ukrainians and the reporting in the United States be so negative?
Yeah, exactly.
And that's now you're talking about getting into the intersections of power here, right? The idea that those who own the media in the United States, well, they also own the weapons companies, they own the fossil fuel companies, they own the banks, they all marry one another, they sit on each other's boards.
Yeah.
It's right. Yeah.
And that's why they get rid of people like me and Tucker Carlson when we start to go up against things like this. Me at CNN and him at Fox, interestingly enough.
Right.
You are an absolute delight to talk to. I have so enjoyed this conversation. I felt like it was just you and me at a bar sharing a beer or something, or maybe even not sharing one, but having our own beers. <It's> like, Matt, I really appreciate. Hey, if people want to get a hold of you, what should they do?
I'm on X or Twitter, Matthew P. Ho, P as in Patrick, and also on Substack, Matthew Ho, last name spelled H-O-H.
That's good, man. You're a good American, a good guy, and I really appreciate you coming on. We got to do this again, by the way. Will you come back?
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime, Rick. I appreciate being here, and I appreciate this space for a multitude of reasons. But one, the ability to have a candid, honest conversation about the things that, as you pointed out throughout this as well, the actual costs of the war. Right. I mean, so I think that's one thing I think that makes both of us and probably most of your viewers angry is this notion that there's this resistance against negotiations to end the war in Ukraine. At the same time, how many thousands and thousands are dying, being wrecked, ruined, maimed, and in the families that then have to suffer those losses. Because it might affect the profits of some companies,
right,
or it affects this vision of the American empire.
I agree. Yeah, it's okay. It's okay to disagree with wanting to stop the war for some reason, as long as you're doing it for the right reason. And if the reason you're doing it happens to have everything to do with greed, then you're not doing it for the right reason. And that just looks and smells to me like what's happening right here. What a great conversation. Thanks again, Matt. We'll look forward to talking to you, my friend.
All right. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks to you for being with us, by the way. What an interesting man, huh? I can't believe what he just shared with us, what he just said about the fact that he was in a meeting that was supposed to be a military command meeting to determine what we were going to do in Afghanistan, and the people who were leading the meeting were members of the military industrial complex, you know, the people from Raytheon and General Dynamics. That's crazy. Think about that for a minute. How bad, how crazy that is, and what a precedent that sets. So they're the ones who are deciding to go to war, and they're the ones making decisions during the war. Sorry. Anyway, you can watch me on YouTube. My platform there is called Journalistically Speaking with Rick Sanchez, and I try to be as journalistically sound as possible. Leave your thoughts there, by the way. I love what you guys share. It's always really good. Also on X, go to Rick Sanchez TV, and we're posting so much there, and we're getting hundreds of thousands of people who are following as well. So thank you. I mean, and thank you for letting us into your home. We'll look for you next time. Good night.